This is the fourth in a series of lectures about the clinical process, following the classic paradigm for patient-clinician interaction introduced in an earlier lecture. In previous lectures, we covered how clinicians gather and analyze data about a patient, and we covered numerous techniques for reaching a diagnosis. In this lecture, we move on to the issue of deciding how to treat or manage the patient's problem once it is well enough understood to do this. As we mentioned earlier, it is easy to think of the clinical process as a fairly straightforward, linear, discrete series of steps. According to this very linear view, one starts with a patient care problem, proceeds to determine a specific diagnosis, then incorporates scientific evidence, and often local organizational imperatives to choose an appropriate treatment, resulting in resolution of the problem. This may happen on occasion, but more often, this view is overly simplistic. A more realistic view is depicted in this slide. Once again, the process begins with a patient care problem. We generally try to reach a specific diagnosis, but very often, one cannot be determined, or there is a need to begin the management process before diagnostic testing is complete. So a diagnosis is not always available or necessary to move on to problem management. Once again, with a working diagnosis in hand, one can incorporate scientific evidence and organizational imperatives to make decisions about management. But very often, there are other considerations that need to be taken into account. First among these are coexisting conditions, current or past illnesses or medications which have an impact on the treatment decisions for the new problem. A patient with kidney disease may not be able to metabolize certain medications. A patient with diabetes, it may be desirable to treat high blood pressure in a different way than in other patients. After considering these coexisting conditions, one must also take into account the patient's preferences. Patients may have different views about different treatment choices, such as surgery or medication, or about treating the condition at all. And these preferences must be taken into account in devising any management plan. Furthermore, one must also take into account social factors, the patient's job, significant others, family members, current housing situation, all of which may have bearing on the treatment choices that can be made. Another set of considerations are local practices. This applies not just in rural areas where resources or expertise may be constrained, but also in tertiary medical centers, where local experience or preference for particular procedures or treatments may differ from the experience or preferences at other institutions. Theoretically, one might hope that these choices would be driven solely by scientific evidence and the other factors we've discussed. But very often, the scientific evidence alone does not settle the question, and the experience and preferences of local specialists may be a significant and driving factor. Furthermore, the experience of a clinician himself or herself has some bearing on which is the best treatment for the patient. In general, a clinician is going to perform better doing a procedure with which she or he is familiar than one which is new. The same applies to prescribing familiar drugs compared to old ones. This issue is addressed well in Gawande's book, Complications. Last, but by no means least, are economic constraints. The most highly recommended, scientifically supported medication or treatment simply may not be available to a patient depending on their insurance plan or economic situation. All these factors must be taken into account to devise a management plan and manage the patient's problem. Listed here are some specific examples of each of these kinds of considerations. First, coexisting conditions. A patient with high blood pressure who also has diabetes should first be treated with a type of drug called an ACE inhibitor, as these have special benefits in diabetics. Second, patients' preferences may well drive whether or not a prostate screening test called PSA should be ordered, since this decision is very strongly preference-centive. A third example is a person dying of lung cancer who is an immigrant from the Mong regions of Laos and Cambodia, and who would prefer not to die at home, contrary to our usual assumption in hospice and palliative care. Economic limitations come into play when a new murmur is discovered, but the patient has no insurance to pay for diagnostic testing, and a watch-and-wait approach is taken. Scientific evidence would drive the decision to choose a proton pump inhibitor instead of a histamine blocker when treating heartburn, even if price would be a concern with the better agent. Local practices may come into play in determining referrals for procedures in specialty care. Well-trained and well-thought-of specialists may have different preferences or inclinations for treating certain conditions. A clinician's own experience comes into play when choosing medications or treatments because, in general, that clinician will perform better and more safely using a familiar procedure or drug than a new one, even if the new one is said to be better. Finally, organizational imperatives may drive choices beyond what the clinician and patient think, such as when the formulary of a health plan or hospital restrict choices of certain drugs within a particular category. As mentioned earlier, a formal approach can be taken to making decisions about interventions using a technique called decision analysis. This technique is too complex for use at the bedside or in individual decisions in most cases, but it may be used to determine policy or guidelines, and in certain circumstances, if the problem is well formulated and the data is available, it can be applied to individual patients. The slide illustrates a conventional decision analysis tree where three options are available for the treatment of anginal chest pain following coronary artery bypass graft: medical treatment, angioplasty, or another bypass. For each of these outcomes, the patient may have similar possible outcomes: improvement, deterioration, or death. Each of these outcomes has a different probability depending on the treatment and a different utility depending on the patient's preferences. If we can determine these utilities or disutilities and probabilities with sufficient precision, we can actually calculate the expected utility of each choice to know which choice should be preferred. In some circumstances, known as a toss-up, even the decision analysis cannot make a determination because it's too close to call. These tend to be what are called preference-sensitive decisions, meaning they depend much more on the preferences of the patient than on the treatment results. Decision analysis has also been used to help us understand our biases in cases where the decisions we make do not match what would be predicted based on this formal decision analytic procedure. Another mathematical approach that is used not so much at the bedside as to set policy and devise guidelines is cost-effectiveness analysis. Shown here is an example of using a Markov model to understand the cost-effectiveness and incremental cost-effectiveness of a particular medical approach. In this case, the question is whether men at risk for gastric cancer should undergo early endoscopic evaluation. A model is created that reflects the options available and the possible outcomes for individuals who undergo these options. The calculation is then performed based on the assumption that these choices are made for an entire population, and this calculation determines the cost-effectiveness or incremental cost-effectiveness of performing the procedure for differing age groups. Such information can be used for setting policy, and if sufficient information were available in an individual case in a particular context, could potentially be used to help with individual treatment decisions. This slide illustrates the SOAP, or SOAP note format, introduced by Lawrence Weed in 1968 in a landmark article entitled "Medical Records That Guide and Teach." According to this format, which was widely adopted in healthcare after its publication, notes in the clinical record are recorded using a structure for each patient problem. Subjective, being information obtained from the patient. Objective, being observations made by the clinician or obtained from the laboratory. Assessment, referring to the clinician's determination of the problem and its severity. And plan, being a management plan for this particular patient at this particular time. Importantly, we divided the plan into three parts: diagnostic, therapeutic, and patient education. This becomes a useful device to remind clinicians to think about each of these separately and include the patient education plan for every problem. Note that the structure of Weed's soap note also matches that of scientific argument, with the statement of the problem followed by presentation of the data, then by an interpretation of what this data means, and conclusions for what should be done. Weed's intention was that we enforce this order to help us think clearly, considering the data before reaching a conclusion. The logic is embedded in the structure. Entering this information in a different order might result in different thinking. The aim of this system is also to produce continuity over time. Weed suggested that each problem have a specific number, and that these numbers be used in each problem that addresses this problem, so that a particular condition could be followed over time. Obviously, and predicted by Weed at the time, our current electronic medical records can potentially make this continuity much easier to achieve. Here is an example of such a plan using the Weed system. We've crossed out the words diagnosis and treatment to remind us that an exact diagnosis is often not available when the plan is made and may never be. It is also to remind us that in many cases it is not a treatment plan but a management plan that is needed, one that includes diagnostic testing or monitoring, one that includes other elements of management besides treatment, especially for conditions that are not treatable, and one that includes patient education and engagement. It was Leeds' original intent that there would be a separate soap note for each problem. The more common practice since that time has been to repeat a single common subjective section, a single common objective section, and then a separate assessment and plan section for each problem. Another consideration that is especially important in primary or ambulatory care settings and chronic conditions is the importance of staging the plan. There may be diagnostic tests or treatment interventions which will only be needed if the initial testing or initial treatment do not remedy the problem. In the hospital, with its very foreshortened time horizon, this kind of staging of the plan is much harder to accomplish. But in the outpatient setting, it may be very appropriate and is often employed, though somewhat difficult to lay out given current tools. Pictured here is a simple table that is meant to represent such an evolving management plan. Across the top, we see a column for a problem for the initial plan, for the secondary plan, and for the tertiary plan. For example, looking at the first row, under GI conditions, a patient appears to have heartburn or gastroesophageal reflux disease. The initial plan is a trial of therapy with a proton pump inhibitor, which in 80% of cases will work. If this is not effective, then the plan is for the patient to come back to make a decision about further workup, possibly including a diagnostic test called esophagogastroduodenoscopy, which is usually definitive but always expensive. Similarly, we can see in the second row the possibility of peptic ulcer disease and bleeding is being considered. The initial plan is to obtain blood tests to see if anemia has developed or to see if there is blood in the stool. If both of these prove to be normal, then no further steps may be taken. But if either of them is abnormal, then the secondary plan of an esophagogastroduodenoscopy is undertaken. And if that shows the disease is caused by Helicobacter pylori, a germ that causes ulcers, then treatment for that condition is to be given. This treatment, however, may be expensive and may be restricted by some health plans. So the logical procedure may be to follow this evolving plan that proceeds through stages depending on the results of the preceding stage. Again, though such a staged management plan may be the ideal, it is difficult to execute in the hospital because of the very short time horizon and the need not to prolong hospital stay any longer than necessary. It is similarly difficult to execute in the ambulatory setting because of substantial constraints on clinician time and patient access.